Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
And good afternoon and welcome to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Matthew Bunsen filling in for Al, who remains in our prayers, of course, and will be in our prayers for a very long time. As you may have heard yesterday, Marcus Peter, who's been filling in for Al also, is with his wife, who went into labor yesterday morning. They're overjoyed to announce the birth of their daughter, Bernadette Rose, and thank everyone for their prayers. I have the privilege of filling in for today. In case you don't know who I am, I'm a vice president and editorial director for EWTN News. I'm also a senior fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and in my spare time, I try to write books. I'm also the documentary founder of a series for EWTN called The Doctors of the Church. A lot of fun things to work on, a great privilege to work on them, but it's also a great delight to be with you this afternoon, especially given the fact that there's so much happening in the world that's worth talking about. We start with Maryland, where a federal appeals court ruled this week that parents in Maryland have no right to be informed when their children are being instructed with LGBTQ materials or to opt their children out of that instruction. You actually heard that right. Yes, an appeals court ruled that parents have no right to be informed when their children are actually being instructed in LGBTQ indoctrination or materials or to opt them out. What does all of this mean for families everywhere? Well, we're going to have a conversation with Andrea Picciotti-Bear, who's legal analyst for EWTN News. She also directs the Conscience Project. You can follow her on Twitter at Bear Picciotti. She's a brilliant legal mind who can tell us what, not just what it means, but also what the ramifications are. And what are the odds of this surviving further appeal? We're also going to be joined by Shannon Mullen, who is the editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. We're going to talk about Harrison Butker, the kicker for the Kansas City Chiefs, who has been much in the news the last few days for a commencement address he gave at Benedictine College. Let's just say there has been quite the uproar. He's also going to tell us about an interview with 60 Minutes that Pope Francis gave. It basically takes aim at his conservative critic, so-called, in the United States. He is reportedly saying that a conservative is someone who, quote, clings to something and does not want to see beyond that. We're also going to talk about the National Eucharistic Congress pilgrimages that are underway starting this weekend. And if we have time, we'll discuss the FACE Act, because there are sentences being handed down. And then, of course, there's the major news of the day, which was the promulgation of a new decree from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith on what? On Marian apparitions and supernatural phenomenon. So a lot to discuss, and I'm delighted to have guests for this hour to unpack all of it. But first, here's the news.
Thanks, Matthew. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, May 17th. It's the Feast of St. Julius Cesano. Today's news brought to you by Ave Maria University. Your vocation location is at avemaria.edu. The first ever interview of a pope by a U.S. network will air this weekend. CBS News' Nora O'Donnell recently sat down with Pope Francis, who was taking aim at his conservative critics. In an interview with 60 Minutes airing this Sunday, he reportedly said that a conservative is someone who, quote, clings to something and does not want to see beyond that, and said such an attitude is suicidal. He also added that it is one thing to take tradition into account, to consider situations from the past, but quite another to be closed up inside a dogmatic box. More on this story coming up this hour. Cleanup efforts are underway in Houston after a severe storm left 4 people dead and nearly 700,000 without power last night.
We had a storm with 100 miles per hour winds, the equivalent of Hurricane Ike, considerable damage downtown.
Houston Mayor John Whitmire said glass was blown out of some downtown buildings and trees and power lines were knocked out throughout the city. The mayor said it may take days to restore power in some areas. PGA Championship frontrunner Scottie Scheffler played in round two today, despite being arrested by Louisville police earlier this morning. This comes as the second round of the tournament was delayed almost an hour and a half following a fatal traffic accident outside the Valhalla Golf Club. Scheffler was not involved in the accident, but was placed in handcuffs by a police officer he drove past while trying to enter the property. Scheffler had reportedly been charged with reckless driving and second-degree assault of a police officer who sustained injuries trying to get Scheffler to stop. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
As I just mentioned, a federal appeals court on Wednesday ruled that parents in Maryland have no right to be informed when their children are being instructed with LGBTQ materials or to opt their children out of that instruction. The legal advocacy group Beckett Law, which is representing the parents challenging the Montgomery County Board of Education, made the point just a couple of days ago that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a lower court's ruling. That's might be interpreted as a somewhat ominous development. The question now is what is going to happen next? But what does this also tell us about where we are in this wider, I won't use the term culture war, but this wider imposition of gender ideology from courts and also from school districts? To help us understand that, I'm delighted to be joined by Andrea Picciotti-Bear, who is a legal analyst for EWTN News and also a great friend. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Matthew. That's my favorite claim to fame, is that I consider you a good friend as well. And you're absolutely right that there is an ominous cloud hanging over our public school systems and affecting parental rights and chipping away at basically the nature of the human being, you know, what it means to be male and female as God created us. But I don't think that there's the absence of a hope. I think that there is some hope in the case that you mentioned, and I'd love to tell you a little bit of why I think I'm not just a Pollyanna in this case.
Well, we've seen a number of rulings basically go the way of families and other things. There's an obvious hope that if this makes its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, that there is at least that kind of presumed firewall. But as we've seen with Bostock and Obergefell, that might be a faint hope. But yeah, I think that it's a great question for you to answer. Why would you be optimistic here?
You know, first off, I think as people of faith, we're people of hope. But second, I think you're right. You know, absolutely, the Supreme Court has been very clear when it comes to religious freedom, which is one of the primary issues that's being raised by the parents in Montgomery County. They are people from a range of faith traditions who say that the school board's inclusion of pride storybooks for children as young as 3 years old that are in the school system up until eighth grade interferes with their rights as primary educators and undermines religious teaching on the nature of the human person. Now, what's interesting about this case is its procedural posture. And for anyone who's not a lawyer, you know that lawyers love to look at the details. And this was a decision the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said that there just wasn't enough in the record to warrant what's called a preliminary injunction. And that means stopping the school board from using these books in its English language curriculum while the case was being reviewed on its merits. I think that decision is gravely wrong and cries out for reversal. But when you look at the opinion of the majority, which I completely disagree with, they don't come out and say they think there's no way to win this case. They just think we need to see a little bit more in the record on how these books are going to be used. Again, I disagree with them, but I think they leave an opening for the parents to win and for other parents to continue to push back on the inclusion of information in the curriculum of especially young children that is not what parents want for their children and has nothing to do with education.
Right. Well, let's go back to the U.S. District Court that had originally ruled against them in August of last year, right? because that was a 2-to-1 ruling, so it was divided. But there was some of the language that was used here that the court itself was arguing in part that the parents are not pressured into violating their religious beliefs in order to obtain the benefits of a public education. But the other, there's a phrase that was used there, and I wanted to ask you about this, that the plaintiffs have, quote, not shown a cognizable burden to the free exercise of their religion. That's another one of those legal terms. What does that mean exactly for the average layperson?
So a lot of this, Matthew, has to deal with judicial restraint. Courts don't want to get into things without having a full understanding of the case before them. And so when plaintiffs, like in this case, the parents of Montgomery County, represented by the religious freedom powerhouse, Beckett Law, when they filed their claim, they also filed a request for, as I mentioned before, a preliminary injunction. And that's kind of a big move by a court to basically reach into the operations of a school district and say, you can't do this right now. While we're reviewing the case on its merits, we're going to stop you from doing that. And in order to basically authorize a court to do that, you have to really reach a high burden. I disagree with the two judges on the Court of Appeals panel in saying that the parents didn't meet their burden. I think they did. And I also think that there's something perverse going on here. In order to meet their burden, the judges in the majority said you had to prove that there was going to be some injury to the religious freedom. And in general, that kind of turns things on their head, especially when we're dealing with young people. You know, to ask parents to sit back and wait until an injury happens. You know, I'm a parent of a large family. I would never do that, you know. And none of the parents in Montgomery County that are part of this lawsuit would shy away from that. But I do think that it's an important thing to continue to push back. And as we mentioned, not just the Supreme Court is there to reverse this case, but Beckett could bring what's called a petition for rehearing en banc. And that's by all of the judges on the court. I'm not quite sure where they're going to go. They have indicated that they will appeal the decision. But I think it's an important thing for us to recognize that we shouldn't be asking people to suffer a grave and oftentimes irreparable injury to religious freedom and especially the formation of young people in order to get help from the courts.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other aspects to this in the language of this this court from last year, and I wanted to get your take on this, is they argue that there's no evidence at present that the board's decision not to permit opt-outs compels the parents or their children to change their religious beliefs or conduct either at school or elsewhere, to the point that you're making that there's no demonstration of injury. But it's fairly clear the levels of influence that these types of programs can have on children. Just we look, for example, at the influence of TikTok on a whole generation. So how does one go about quantifying the damage that could potentially be done as these children are being bluntly indoctrinated into some of this?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And there's just a lack of common sense. You know, the whole purpose of our school system is to influence and to form young minds. And it should be in partnership with parents. You know, obviously parents are the primary educators, and we choose the schools, whether we send our children to public schools or to private schools, to work with us. If a school didn't think they were having an impact, then the school should probably shutter their doors. And so it does seem very counterintuitive that the school would, on the one case, want to push through this in as part of their curriculum, and on the other hand, say, hey, we're not really going to be influencing these children. So then why are you doing it? You know, the other thing that I think is a bigger argument is in Maryland, there is a right, as is there in most states in the country, to opt your children out of delicate issues that are the province of parents on human sexuality and family relations. This touches upon it. And the Montgomery School Board is almost trying to do a workaround. Rather than have a gender identity class, what they've done is they've put made it part of the English language curriculum. And we're seeing more and more that seeping into the curriculum that children are having. It's not like you can just send the kid to the library while health class is going on. This stuff is permeating everything that children are being exposed to, whether it's history, language, social studies. And that's something that even outside of the courts, parents need to keep pushing their school boards, pressing them, and saying, what the heck does this have to do with educating our children?
Right. Well, I mean, we've all seen videos of some of these teachers from grade schools who for whatever reason, choose to be very performative and discuss what they're doing on places like TikTok, of how they're integrating a whole LGBTQ agenda into, like, math classes. So you're absolutely right in that. But has this also not sparked something of a coalition of people like to think, for example, that this is just a bunch of white traditional Catholics or Christians who are upset about this? But this has actually drawn in Muslims and Ethiopian Orthodox and others who are concerned about this, right?
No, absolutely. And there are parents across faith traditions that are asking for answers. They feel that it is an affront to their rights as a parent, affronts to their free exercise rights. What's really interesting about this case, Matthew, is they aren't asking that the school board rescind or pull these books. They're not asking for a ban, which I think that most people should be pushing for a ban. But in court, they're not asking for that. They're only asking for their right to opt their children out. Now, obviously, people with means will be able to say, hey, I'm out of the public school system. For a lot of these parents, they're immigrant parents, their income is, you know, close to the poverty line, and I think this is where the church can shine. We can start offering opportunities, whether or not there's school choice in the state, there isn't in Maryland, to push for that, but also to start creating scholarship funds for families that want to get out of these toxic environments. If their public school is a toxic environment, that we open the Catholic schools to them, because that's the kind of response that Catholics make, is to respect the authority that God has given all parents.
Yeah, so once again, we have a reminder of the importance of supporting Catholic schools or these alternatives as we're trying to reform what we know should be a vibrant and healthy public school system.
Absolutely, Matthew.
Yeah. Well, Andrea, thank you so much for actually injecting some hope into this conversation. I think a lot of people are very concerned about this. A joy to talk to you. When we come back,
thanks, Matthew.
I talked to Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, about the new DDF document on apparitions, and, of course, Harrison Butker. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. Feeding 5,000 from a boy's 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, as recorded in John chapter 6, is quite a miracle. Yet the next day, Jesus downplays it in verse 27. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Likewise, God's provision of manna to the Israelites in the desert was also a great miracle, yet Jesus similarly downplays it in verse 49. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. Jesus is clearly stating that his Eucharist is greater than both of these amazing miracles, and the Catholic Church absolutely takes him at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart-friendly, ride-your-bike-everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort-style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at avemaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. Well, just today at a press conference in Rome, the prefect for the Dicaster for the Doctrine of the Faith, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, introduced a new document. It has an impressive title. It is Norms for Proceeding in the Discernment of Alleged Supernatural Phenomena. If you're wondering what that means, well, Marian apparitions that are being questioned, various other remarkable spiritual phenomena fall under this category. And the Dicastery, the Holy See, has now issued a new set of norms governing how the Church is going to approach them, their validation, their investigation, and what sort of final decision we can make. This may sound a bit like inside baseball for a lot of people, but these actually matter, and these are decisions and these are norms now that are going to guide how dioceses around the world undertake their investigations into these phenomena. So in many ways, the average Catholic is going to be impacted by these very norms that were issued just today. To talk about this, as well as Pope Francis on 60 Minutes, Pope Francis going to Verona, and all of the controversies surrounding Harrison Butker, I think I got his name right, the Kansas City Chiefs kicker, who seems to be in quite a bit of controversy on social media. I'm joined with great joy, on my part at least, by Shannon Mullen, the editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, who is very kind in joining me sometimes when I fill in, and I also have the privilege of calling him a friend. So, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. It's great to be here. Always a pleasure.
So, Pope Francis has, in his prefect for the Dicaster, the Doctrine of the Faith, an individual who seems very motivated to issue decrees and to right from the start of what fall of last year, he has been issuing one decree after another. We have fiducia supplicans, we had dignitas infinita, and now we have norms for proceeding in the discernment of alleged supernatural phenomena. Let's take a step back for a second. What's your sense of why he's moving at this pace?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that we have to remember this is the latter phases or latter years, certainly, of Pope Francis's pontificate. And hopefully we'll have many, many more years with Francis. But Fernandez, even in his press conferences, he just seems ready for action.
Yes, he does. He seems to love the sort of the scrap with the press too.
Yes, he does, and even in these norms, there's it's explicitly addressed that in the past these investigations could drag on, sometimes for many years. Fernandez is not that type of prefect to let things drag on, so we'll see. You know, will this actually accelerate? Will there be more transparency with these norms? It does seem, though, that this is another instance where there is some sort of centralization of authority, of power back at the Vatican, which sort of stands in contrast to a lot of what Francis has emphasized during his pontificate is sort of a decentralization. But there's plenty of exceptions to that.
Yeah, well, let's talk about this document then. Here we have a set of norms. This is the first serious revision of norms governing apparitions and supernatural phenomena on the part of the Holy See. The what was at one point the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith now is the Dicaster for the Doctrine of the Faith. We have to go all the way back to 1978 under Pope St. Paul VI for any sort of norms like this. What was Fernandez's rationale for implementing a pretty thoroughgoing reform?
I think the whole theme and emphasis of this document is on the faithful, right? Protecting the faithful. There's a lot of emphasis on where there is good fruits happening that related to something that may or may not be supernatural in origin. There's a sense of encouragement and sort of pastoral care. But on the flip side, where there's some serious issues associated with these alleged incidents, that he wants to also protect the faithful from being misguided and harmed, you know. So that's something that's very evident in the document and in his remarks today.
Yeah. Now, there seem to be two significant developments in this. One you've already touched on, and that is there is an apparent effort at a certain recentralization or centralization of the process. They're not excluding the diocesan bishop. He still has a major role in this, but one has the impression from these norms that every step of the way now they have to engage with the dicastery and final approval rests with the dicastery. That's new, right?
Yes, and I think a little bit of, you said, inside baseball, and we got a little peek behind the curtain, as it were, because there was an acknowledgement in the document that really all along, the dicastery or the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, as it was previously known, I don't want to say always, but previously was in close contact with the local bishops, the episcopal conferences where these cases were taking place, and that they were weighing in and authorizing or approving, if that's the correct word, but just not in public. Right, the front person, the front facing person, by and large, has been the local ordinary.
The reality, though, is that the dicastery seems to be assuming more of a decisive role. Especially, I noticed in the norms it talks about that the dicastery reserves the right to intervene, and they use the term motu proprio, in other words, by its own hand, when it sees fit. That's kind of an interesting development, it seems to me.
Yeah, I don't think there's some of that same tone in for example, Traditionis Custodis. The on the one hand, you're empowering the bishops to do certain things, right, and setting forth some norms, but on the other hand, you're creating an explicit role for the DDF to sort of intervene to issue some corrections. So same kind of thing here, I think, is I think what he's thinking of is that the DDF would be able to intervene more quickly into mm-hmm. situations before they kind of get out of control.
Right. The other innovation that I think is being noted by a lot of people is the fact that there seems to be this movement away from a declaration or positive affirmation, or as they say, a declaration with moral certainty, that this apparition is real. In other words, the authenticity of the phenomena. And instead, it mentions that while they are reluctant, while they are not expressing certainty in those cases where they receive a very positive affirmation, in this case called the Nihil Obstat, the authenticity itself is not being affirmed, but the signs of the Holy Spirit are being affirmed, and the local bishop is now allowed to promote pilgrimages and devotion. That's a pretty striking change, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's an acknowledgement that in some cases, even the Vatican doesn't have the means to really verify, you know, the supernatural quality. And I think always the fruits are what the focus has been on, the fruits and the character, the virtue of the people involved. Has always been the character. Those are more easy, not easy, but those are easier to assess. And so I think that's why it's more realistic in a way that that's something that that the bishop or the local or the Episcopal conference could weigh in and make a finding.
Yeah, I always hate to ask you to prognosticate, but do you anticipate that there will be voices raised, perhaps in social media or elsewhere, expressing concern that the church is moving away from actually confirming supernatural phenomena?
I think that's already happening today, right now as we speak, probably on X. But it was really one of my first thoughts. Have we seen the last approved apparition, right?
Right. In
approved
that sense, yeah.
in the sense that it's yes, this has occurred. Maybe. I mean, apparitions are, in some ways, inconvenient things, right? There's a lot of ways that they can go sideways on you, and there's a lot of, it's a bit of a minefield and things like that. So I could see where a pope, if that is reserved to the pope to say this is supernatural or not, it's almost a built-in default that, you know what, I'd rather not weigh in on that.
Yeah, and we'll give the last word to Cardinal Fernandez when he kept stressing that we need to have prudence and discernment in this process.
Yes, yeah.
Talking about whether it's prudent or not to do interviews, Pope Francis is going to be on 60 Minutes this weekend, I believe, with Nora O'Donnell. He is no stranger to interviews, certainly of the television kind, and he appears in all kinds of media. What's the story here?
Part of the story is that this is, I don't know, a new record, right? We've probably crashed the record of the number of interviews that he's done in the past year or so. I mean, really a record. So the story is that we haven't seen the full interview yet. You have to tune in on Sunday and watch 60 Minutes.
Something tells me that was by design, yes.
But we've gotten little previews. The one that was making the rounds yesterday was comments that the Pope made regarding his conservative critics within the church, and he said are trapped in a, quote, suicidal attitude. He had other comments about conservatives of this sort. He said a conservative is someone who, quote, clings to something and does not want to see beyond that. It is a suicidal attitude, he said, because it is one thing to take tradition into account, to consider situations from the past, but quite another is to be closed up inside a dogmatic box. Pretty strong statements from the Pope on conservatives, at least conservative critics.
Consistent with some of the things he has said previously, too. He uses that phrase, indietrismo, this idea of being backward. refusing to look ahead. So we'll see if there's anything shockingly new in this interview. He does stay with his themes. But we know he's also this weekend, while we're all watching him, he'll be in Verona. So we'll have more reporting on that. A lot more to cover the news today with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, here on Cresta in the Afternoon. Don't go anywhere.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile, everyday living, effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
There is genuine consolation from the Catholic Catechism regarding the death of a loved one. The Christian who dies in Christ Jesus, we are told, is away from the body and at home with the Lord. Death marks the end of a Christian's sacramental life, but the fulfillment of his new birth, which began at baptism, now has a definitive conformity to the image of Jesus Christ. The Christian funeral does not give the deceased a sacrament or sacramentals because he or she has passed beyond the sacramental economy. The different funeral rites express the paschal character of Christian death. The greatest consolation to the Christian is the knowledge that even in death, we are separated only temporarily, that one day, if we have lived well, we will all be together again in Christ. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Matthew Bunsen. You know, EWTN's National Catholic Register is America's most trusted Catholic news source with a comprehensive view of the world from a Catholic perspective. You can give a gift subscription or subscribe for yourself and save up to 42%. You can learn more about this at ncregister.com. Again, that's ncregister.com. And let's just say that the recitation of this small plug for the National Catholic Register could not be more appropriate or perhaps providential, given the fact that I'm continuing my conversation with Shannon Mullen, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register. So, Shannon, we want to do everything we can to support the National Catholic Register.
Thanks. I appreciate the plug.
Well, I guess I really would want to. How's it going, the Register?
The Register is going wonderfully. Our website nearly broke from the Harrison Buckner story over this past week, but we're doing okay. I'm really enjoying the role, and there's a lot of exciting stories in the pipeline. So
yeah, well, thank you for providing me with the perfect segue to Harrison Butker. For those who may not be that familiar with him, he is a National Football League. I think he's been in the Pro Bowl many times. Plays for the Kansas City Chiefs. He is a kicker and one of the most reliable in the league. I think it's safe to say that he was a major reason why the Chiefs have won three of the last five Super Bowls, including the game winner, game tie, I guess, that sent the Chiefs into overtime against 49ers in the very last Super Bowl. But that's not why we're talking about it. Why are we talking about it?
Yeah, it's worth noting that the Register readers and EWTN watchers are already familiar with Harrison Buckner. He's been on our platforms in various stories over the years. Even though he's had this incredible run of Super Bowls and so many heroics, right, including in this past year's Super Bowl, people don't remember the kickers, right?
Well, they remember the ones who miss.
Yes. He doesn't miss very often. But my point is that he is an outspoken Catholic, very proud of his faith, very pro-life, a devotee of the traditional Latin Mass. So we've had a number of stories. This is the latest story, but definitely the biggest story. So what happened is last Saturday on May the 11th, he gave the commencement address at Benedictine College in Kansas. Benedictine is a wonderful liberal arts Catholic college, and they have it's just a very dynamic place. And he gave a speech that was really kind of echoing the traditional themes that are important to him. But more than that, he was kind of calling out bishops, not by name, but bishops. Let me back up. He's calling on men to sort of resist the demasculization trend that's going on in our culture. He called on women to embrace their role as women. You know, there's so much gender confusion out there right now, so I think he was trying to sort of cut through that. He called out bishops, American bishops, for not being speaking out courageously enough. And he had some choice words for President Biden. Mm-hmm. Being a Catholic and blessing himself at a pro-abortion rally and things of that nature. But he has there's been an enormous blowback.
And he's a great supporter, as you mentioned, of a very conservative outlook and the TLM. I mean, you can run down the list. But what has been striking in the response to his commencement address, especially in social media, especially in various publications, is how they have fixated on, in some cases, phrases he didn't actually use. I mean, I've seen him accused of being anti-Semitic. I've seen him accused of being anti-LGBT. I think the phrase that he used in his speech, and it was just a kind of a throwaway line about condemning or denouncing people pushing dangerous gender ideologies onto the youth of America. that is something that you're apt to hear in all kinds of different forums, and yet the level of fixation on this address, going all the way to places like The View, the television show, with what many have denounced as very anti-Catholic remarks. What is the cause of this? How did we get to a point where a commencement address in a sort of private Catholic college is now a media frenzy around the world?
Yeah, he came. I'm a fan of his. I think he's an inspiring character. I think he made a lot of great points, and the speech was well received. There were certain passages that were just vague enough that it's sort of a Rorschach test, you know, where you kind of fill in the blanks, right? Mm-hmm. And going back to what I said in the beginning, register readers, EWTN viewers, they know Harrison Butker. So when they fill in the blanks, they know that, well, he's not saying it's wrong for women to have a career.
Right.
He's not saying that, and a lot of the things that he was accused of. He's not making an anti-Semitic remark. So knowing him, you fill in those blanks, right? Not knowing him and seeing him kind of nudge up to some of these third rails, you know, in our culture right now.
We seem to have a lot of them now.
There was a lot of filling in the blanks from the other point of view, that it was hate speech, right? So one of his themes, I think his main message to the graduates is that... if I could quote him, is he says, as members of the church founded by Jesus Christ, it is our duty and ultimately privilege to be authentically and unapologetically Catholic. And, you know, we're reaching the point where just expressing basic normal positions of our faith can be labeled hate speech, and that's very troubling when
right.
you're just, you know, expressing the truths of your faith.
And the anger that seemed to have been accompanying a lot of these posts, I know in our reporting, for example, we know that we're reporting been targeted by the city of Kansas City, Missouri, which shared a now-deleted post on X announcing that what city Butker lives in, which is technically doxing, and I believe that the Attorney General for Missouri has been weighing in on that, again, that deleted post on X. But the level of vitriol that has been directed toward him, but also just the whole concept, this is something that was very much in play on the TV show The View, where he's equated as being a Taliban-like figure.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible now to have a kind of dialogue between these two camps?
Wow. Is it possible? Yes, it is possible. Is it likely? No, I don't think it's likely. Yes, it is possible. You know, we work with Jeanette DiMello. She's our executive director at the Register and for CNA. She recently attended just a couple of weeks ago, a really interesting conference on polarization within the Catholic Church, within Catholic media. And it was, you know, it's very interesting. This past week is like Exhibit A.
Yes.
It's the filling in the blanks. You know, when you're saying anything about LGBT or gender ideology, if it automatically labels you as a hater,
right?
Then how can you have any dialogue? You know,
and also any traditional roles for men and women.
Yes. So I learned only recently when I was reading over some of the coverage. Harrison Butker's mother is a physicist, right? The idea that he's saying that women can't have careers is absurd. And I think the point he was making was that there's a difference between our occupations and our vocations. My vocation is as a husband and a father. It's not as an editor or a journalist. That's my occupation. And I think he was trying to get that message across to the students who are, you know, so eager to get out in the world, to get that first job, to get their careers going on, that, hey, there's something even more important. Nobody has a cooler career than Harrison Butker, you know, working as this dream job as an NFL football player. But it's way down the list for him in importance. And I think that message got really distorted in a remarkable way.
Yeah, so we'll see how this plays out over the next days, I'm assuming. So let's turn our attention, though, to the FACE Act and a number of convictions that have been handed down for pro-life community people. What's the significance of this story?
The FACE Act, part of the story is the FACE Act itself. So this is I'll get you the exact title of what FACE stands for. It's an acronym, Freedom of Access to Clinics, Abortion Clinics. And this was a law that was passed back in the Clinton era, 1994. And there was some violence, actually, pro-life, anti-abortion violence at that time. Congress was reacting to that and passed this very heavy-handed federal law, making it a crime to block access to abortion clinics. And some steep penalties, some steep fines, even prison sentences. But to get it passed... back then, there was some compromises made that this act would also apply to people who tried to prevent people getting to churches or houses of worship. The way it's worded is reproductive health centers or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, that would include pro-life pregnancy centers. And yet, over those decades... with rare exception, it's only been applied to pro-life demonstrators and who have faced, very serious felony crimes and prison terms.
And we are seeing now a rolling number of sentences that are being handed down. It's something that I know from a journalistic standpoint that we're paying very close attention to. I know in the very little time that we have left, we want to talk about the National Eucharistic Congress.
That's the big news this weekend, as far as I'm concerned. So, yes, this really two-plus-month process, crisscrossing, really crossing and making the sign of the cross across our country are these four... routes that are beginning at different places, northeast, west, and south, and they'll ultimately converge on Indianapolis in July, where there's going to be the National Eucharistic Congress. It's going to be, the visuals are going to be amazing. They're going over the Golden Gate Bridge. There'll be a Eucharistic procession over the bridge this weekend and some other really great events to kick it off.
All right. Well, Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, thanks so much. Look forward to continuing this conversation at some point.
Thank you, Matthew.
When we come back, a few closing thoughts here on Cresta in the Afternoon.
The Encounter Conference, June 26th through the 28th at the New Glass City Center in Toledo, Ohio. 15 powerful speakers.
It is the encounter with the Holy Spirit that makes Jesus come alive and gives us the courage and the wisdom to go forth and to even risk our own lives.
Everyone pretty much says the miracles that Jesus did are real. The miracles that the early church did are real.
As often as the popes are talking about the new evangelization, they're also saying we need to pray for a new Pentecost. We need to return to the upper room. Encounter represents the church returning to the upper room. As we're coming boldly before God and asking Him to renew that Pentecostal fire for the strength, the gifts, and the wisdom to be able to preach Jesus to a lost and broken world so that we can become fully alive in Him, so that the world may come to believe that Jesus is the one whom God sent.
Register today at EncounterConference.org. That's EncounterConference.org.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Learn and spread the word about the food, clothing, parenting classes, financial assistance that these resource centers provide moms, and not just for a few weeks after the baby is born, but often for up to 4 years after birth. Don't assume that just because you haven't heard about pro-life resources or efforts that they don't or aren't available, or that the church hasn't been involved. The media, and I know this firsthand from my years of experience, have been working with the abortion industry to suppress information about resources, as well as totally misrepresent or blatantly lie about what the pro-life community offers moms and families in need. And last but not least, do some homework and prayerfully give thanks to these pro-life warriors and consider becoming a pro-life warrior yourself.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
Well, my thanks, as always, for the privilege of filling in as guest host here on Cresta in the Afternoon. Of course, the guys, the production staff makes this so simple that even I can do it, as I always say. My thanks, too, in this hour for the gift of Andre Pachotti-Bear and also Shannon Mullen. Great conversation about this new document from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. One thing that Cardinal Fernandez kept stressing was the reality, the truth of private revelation, and the importance of understanding the difference between that and public revelation. I say that because this is also an opportunity for us with the release of this document to not just read this document, but also to go back and really appreciate the beauty of the Marian apparitions that have been approved over the history of the church, and to deepen our faith to the better understanding of private revelation as well. Privileged to be with you as always. Please take care. God bless. This is Matthew Bunsen.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.